This episode features discussion of kidnapping, murder, violence against children, and childhood sexual abuse that some people may find offensive, disturbing, or upsetting. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. If you are aware of a child who is being abused or neglected, you can report this to the National Child Abuse Hotline, reachable at 1-800-4-A-CHILD, which is 1-800-422-4453. You can also visit childwelfare.gov for state-by-state resources for reporting child abuse or neglect.
On her 10th birthday, December 30th, 1992, Katie Beers was promised a bigger gift than she had ever dreamed of receiving.
The only problem was, the person making promises was none other than Katie's kidnapper, John Esposito. In a bunker buried deep under John's detached garage in Bayshore, Long Island, Katie was on her third day of captivity.
Katie begged John Esposito to let her go, but he told her she would have to stay in the bunker until people forgot about her. When she asked how she was supposed to grow up and have children, he told her she would have children with him.
When that didn't stop Katie's tears, John offered her a present, his red and black Camaro, along with $100 for every day she had to stay in the bunker.
The only catch? He would give her those gifts on her 18th birthday. Today was her 10th birthday. Katie couldn't imagine living 8 more years in this bunker.
And she wouldn't have to. Katie's incredible resilience was on its way to saving her life. 10-year-old Katie had begun psychologically manipulating 44-year-old John Esposito. She didn't know it yet, but her strategy was working.
This is Hostage, the new Parcast podcast telling the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We also delve into psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations, as well as explore the psychological toll captivity takes on the human brain. We're your hosts, Carter and Irma.
You can listen to all of Parcast podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday.
If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
Today, we're continuing our deep dive into the kidnapping of Katie Beers, who spent 17 days locked in a closet-sized underground bunker built just for her.
Last week, we delved into Katie's horrific early childhood and the life of her kidnapper, who was nicknamed Big John. We also talked about how he took Katie from the home of her abusive mother figure, Linda Ingalleri.
This week, we'll tell you about Katie's 17 days underground in 1992 and 1993. We'll learn how she was rescued, not just through the efforts of the dedicated detectives searching for her, but through her own incredible ability to use psychology, a subject she was far too young to study, to manipulate her kidnapper.
And we'll discover why Katie, today a happy and healthy young mother, says that her harrowing kidnapping ultimately helped her to escape abuse and live a normal life. We'll also discuss the psychology behind Katie's unusual ability to recover from unimaginable amounts of trauma.
When we left her, Katie was on her third day of captivity. She would live in the underground bunker with only a trash bag for a toilet for 2 more weeks.
Only 3 days into her ordeal, Katie had already taken stock of her situation and realized that her survival would depend on her own ingenuity. After police officers searched Big John's house and failed to discover the carefully concealed entrance to the bunker, Katie knew she couldn't count on being found.
What was worse, John Esposito had started sexually abusing Katie. Tragically, this was something Katie expected based on her experience with her informally adopted uncle, Sal Ingalleri, In fact, Katie says John asked about her sexual history before he raped her and was excited to hear that she had been raped before.
Katie doesn't know how many times she was sexually assaulted in the bunker. She knows it happened more than once. And she remembers a blank look on John Esposito's face when he entered the bunker with the intent to sexually assault her.
Sometimes Big John would come into the bunker to give Katie food or a toy, and then suddenly the blank look would appear on his face and he would rape her. One clue about Big John's mental state is how long he remained in denial about sexually abusing Katie. It took more than 20 years for Big John to admit he molested Katie, and even then, he denied raping her.
If Big John really believed he loved children, it would have been hard for him to reconcile that with the obvious evidence he was seriously harming Katie, which could lead to denial, a psychological coping mechanism.
On the other hand, when John Esposito did finally confess, he blamed his lawyers for telling him not to admit to touching Katie.
There is one explanation that falls somewhere between extreme denial and willful cruelty. Catherine Ramslin, PhD, co-author of the book Inside the Minds of Sexual Predators, says one of the most common types of child predators is the, quote, fixated child offender. Fixated child offenders are stuck at an early stage of psychosexual development and rationalize away their abuse of children as showing affection. They may know their actions are wrong, but their fixation on children overrides their moral sensibilities.
So John might have known he was hurting Katie, but because he was fixated and felt unable to stop, he tried to convince himself he was actually helping her.
Big John's grand gestures, like the promise of a car and a huge amount of money on her 18th birthday, seem like further rationalizations of this abuse. He was able to convince himself that kidnapping and sexual abuse were actually a net benefit to his victim.
Big John had molested children before, and in those cases too, he cast himself as a helpful male role model in their lives. Among John Esposito's victims, Katie's 16-year-old maternal half-brother, John Beers.
During the investigation of Katie's kidnapping, John Beers, nicknamed Little John, told news reporters that John Esposito molested him regularly for 7 years. Although Little John felt it was important to tell reporters what had happened to him, in the same interview, he said he didn't want Big John punished because he was a friend.
Reporters asked if Little John thought of John Esposito as a friend because of gifts and favors done for his family. Little John denied it and repeated that Big John was a friend.
Little John's complicated feelings about Big John might have stemmed in part from a culture of silence regarding male victims of sexual violence.
Estimates by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control say that approximately 1 in 6 men are sexually abused before the age of 18, but boys and men are less likely than girls and women to report their abuse.
This underreporting may happen because boys and men tend not to define their own experiences as sexual abuse. In one study, only 16% of men with well-documented histories of sexual abuse considered themselves to be survivors of sexual abuse, compared to the 64% of women with similar histories.
Given those statistics, it was incredibly brave of Little John to tell a group of reporters that he was sexually abused by Big John.
Katie and Little John were only half-siblings, but it seems they had more than a few things in common, including a keen sense of intuition. Little John also told reporters it was his, quote, gut feeling that John Esposito had abused Katie. This only increased their suspicion of Esposito.
Meanwhile, back in the bunker, Big John told Katie over and over that he loved her, and that he had only taken her to protect her. He insisted that he would keep her forever, and they would have children together.
Rightly, Katie presumed that if Big John believed he loved her and was protecting her, he would want her to love him back. So she told him she loved him, but only if he would release her. She promised to run far away and never tell the police who took her.
She even promised to come visit Big John all the time, if only he would let her go. She would tell police that she had faked her own kidnapping to get away from Sal Ingoleri, who was awaiting trial for sexually abusing Katie.
John Esposito appeared unmoved by Katie's attempts to negotiate her own release. She recounts in her memoirs, Buried Memories, how she cycled through different attitudes and personalities, from nice to mean and everything in between. But Big John kept insisting that her new life was in the bunker.
Katie was slowly chipping away at Big John's will to keep her captive, but it would be 2 long weeks before her manipulations paid off.
And during those 2 weeks, Katie became the most famous girl on Long Island, maybe even the most famous girl in America.
Up next, we'll see what the national spotlight revealed. Now back to the story.
When we left Katie Beers, it was December 30th, her 10th birthday, and the 3rd day of her captivity. Katie was beginning to manipulate her captor, John Esposito. She had realized he believed he loved her and that he wanted Katie to love him in return. At only 10 years old, Katie was analyzing her captor's psychological profile and trying different negotiation tactics to secure her release.
Meanwhile, outside the bunker, Katie's story captivated news audiences across America. Katie's torturous life drew comparisons to the fictional character Little Orphan Annie. But for poor Katie, there was no rich Daddy Warbox to save her.
Her kidnapping wasn't the first time Katie had to persevere through hardship. She lived for several years with her disabled mother figure, Linda Ingoleri, who beat Katie and treated her like a servant. Linda's husband, Sal, sexually abused Katie. When Katie reported the abuse, her biological mother, Marilyn, took her back. But with Marilyn, Katie lived in a house teeming with cockroaches and was almost totally ignored. But now, the Invisible Girl was on every TV station. The New York Times updated readers on the search for Katie almost daily.
Katie's newfound fame meant that everyone who ever knew her was speaking to reporters, and a disturbing pattern quickly emerged.
Merchants in West Islip, where Katie spent most of her life, remembered a dirty child with yellow teeth, underdressed for the weather, and always unattended. A laundromat operator named Trudy said Katie was terribly thin. But Trudy never spoke to authorities about the child doing load after load of adults' laundry.
The mother of a neighborhood girl recalled Katie asking her daughter if her father ever touched her. The mother overheard the conversation, intuited Katie had been abused, and tried to get Katie to tell her what had happened. But the young mother never called police to tell them about her suspicions.
The daughter of a greeting card store owner even confronted Linda Ingoleri directly about Katie's knotted hair and dirty appearance. But when Linda brushed off the criticism, the store owner's daughter didn't take further action.
Authorities had Sal Ingoleri's signed confession to molesting Katie, but they took no steps to prevent Katie from living as a ward of the Ingoleri family. They had a credible allegation of sexual abuse against John Esposito, but he was never charged. At least 2 visits by Child Protective Services led to no action, even when Linda Ingoleri threatened a social worker and chased her out of the house.
It seemed like the sheer number of people who knew Katie was in danger actually made it less likely that anyone would intervene. And that's actually exactly what a psychological phenomenon called the bystander effect would lead us to expect. Studies of the bystander effect show that about 70% of people would help a victim of a crime if they were the only witness, while only about 40% would help if there were other witnesses present.
Even that number seems high. If 40% of those people who knew about Katie's abuse had acted decisively to help her, things might have turned out differently.
According to the Economic and Social Research Council, quote, 2 main factors come into play in the bystander effect. 1 is the diffusion of responsibility. with many others present, the responsibility is shared throughout the group and no one feels that it's down to them to do anything. The other is our desire to conform and follow the actions of others. When no one else does anything, it's easier to feel that it's not necessary or even appropriate to take action." End quote.
So the neighbors who knew Katie was in danger felt that it was everyone else's problem, and that if everyone else was doing nothing about it, then nothing must be the right thing to do.
Exactly. But even if we can understand the inaction of neighbors as a function of the bystander effect, that still doesn't explain why Suffolk County Police and Child Protective Services didn't help Katie.
While Katie languished in her underground bunker, America wanted answers. Suffolk County legislators were suddenly facing down mobs of journalists.
Legislator Alan Binder, who headed the Committee for Health and Human Services, stammered his way through an interview in which he said that since Katie's kidnapping, a, quote, flood of calls had come into his office about other children ignored by CPS. Some of those children died, he admitted, but he stopped short of taking responsibility on behalf of CPS for their deaths.
While reporters and the public pressured local authorities, police hoped for a break in the case.
Detective Lieutenant Dominic Verone of the Suffolk County Police suspected John Esposito from the start. It was just too coincidental that a suspected pedophile with the history of attempted kidnapping was the last person to see a young kidnapped victim, the sister of a boy molested by the very same man.
But as the days ticked on, more and more of Verone's men began to believe that Katie would be found dead, if at all.
Verone's gut told him that not only was Katie alive, she was with someone who thought they were protecting her. The more he saw of slovenly perverted Sal Ingallary, who had confessed to molesting Katie, and of dueling mother figures Marilyn and Linda, the more Verone believed that someone had stolen Katie in a misguided effort to get her out of that awful family.
Among Verone's strangest allies, a gaggle of clairvoyants. By January 7th, 1993, 11 days after Katie vanished, with her story all over the news, not one, not two, but four local psychics offered to donate their time to help with the case.
On Thursday, January 7th, an unnamed psychic working with Linda Ingallary found a mysterious note at the Ingallary's home. Written in childlike handwriting, it was signed Catherine and indicated that Aunt Linda was Katie's favorite person in the world.
Awfully convenient, Linda's psychic discovering such a thing right in the middle of a very public custody battle between Aunt Linda and the girl's biological mother, Marilyn Beers.
That must have occurred to Marilyn, too, because she promptly hired her own psychic. John Monty was a former house painter from Massachusetts. But for Marilyn's purposes, he would do just fine. Marilyn hired him as her spokesman.
According to the book, 17 Days, the Katie Beers Story, Monty insisted on seeing Lieutenant Verone as soon as possible.
Verone, busy pursuing physical evidence, refused to speak with the psychic, but a detective at the 4th Precinct took down John Monty's information.
We know it's confusing that so many of the men in this story are named John, so to recap, John Beers, nicknamed Little John, is Katie's half-brother, age 16. John Esposito, nicknamed Big John, is her kidnapper. And John Monty is the psychic hired by Marilyn Beers.
John Monty told the police that Katie was alive, underground, and hidden behind a red door. He also told them she was with John Esposito, and that the voicemail she left for Linda Ingallary was recorded from a phone booth outside Spaceplex.
Monty was right about most of this. Although when police asked where the phone booth was, he didn't correctly identify the Amoco station where John Esposito played Katie's tape message into a payphone to confuse police. Instead, Monty pointed to a payphone the opposite direction from Spaceplex.
And there was no red door. But Katie had been underground and alive for nearly 2 weeks since she was kidnapped, and she was regrettably with John Esposito.
The FBI agreed with Monty's report. By this time, analysts had listened to Katie's voice on the answering machine and said it sounded like she was recording in a soundproof booth. The total lack of background noise on the tape, made in the underground bunker, sounded nothing like a voicemail recorded by a little girl using the phone at a busy gas station. Because of this, Verone again upped the pressure on Esposito. Knowing he risked a complaint of police harassment, Verone searched Big John's home a second time. He hoped a second search would pressure Esposito into confessing. Instead, he found an unexpected clue in Big John's bedroom: the instruction manual for a tape recorder. Now, Lieutenant Verone felt certain that Katie's voicemail was pre-recorded by Big John.
With detectives watching his every move, Big John couldn't afford to visit Katie as often. Now, almost 2 weeks into her captivity, he was visiting only once a day. This meant less abuse for Katie, but also fewer opportunities to manipulate Big John, and fewer chances to use the detached commode filled with a garbage bag in the center of the room.
Among the many horrifying choices in Katie's young life, her decisions about relieving herself were some of the most shocking. She cleverly stole a key from Big John that unlocked the padlock chaining her neck to the wall of the coffin-sized box inside the bunker, where she was expected to stay between visits from Big John.
But if she got out of the box to use the garbage bag commode when he wasn't there, he would know that she had the key and would change the lock. And if she went to the bathroom when Big John was visiting, it was just another chance for him to see her naked and get aroused and then rape her.
So Katie made a smart but awful choice. She used part of her box underneath the television at the end of her tiny camping mattress as a bathroom. In her memoir, Katie recounts the shame that came from sleeping next to her excrement and having only her dirty nightgown to wipe herself with.
When Katie did see Big John, she worried about him. He was becoming more and more distressed. He started talking frequently about killing himself.
So Katie found herself in the terrible position of consoling her rapist. She knew if John Esposito died, nobody would ever find her. The entrance to the bunker was just too well concealed. Katie would starve to death without Big John's visits.
Again, displaying her resilience and innate understanding of psychology, Katie reassured Big John. She avoided saying anything that might upset him.
Once, when Big John became offended that Katie didn't want to have children with him, she came up with an impersonal reason. By the time she was old enough to have babies, Big John would be too old to get her pregnant. It wasn't a rejection, she assured him. It was just impractical.
Katie told Big John over and over that she loved him so that he wouldn't kill himself or her or both of them. But even as she spoke loving words to her kidnapper, she was constantly on guard.
For the entire 17 days of her captivity, Katie refused to eat anything that wasn't brought to her in its original packaging. If Big John prepared a meal for her, she shoved it aside and refused to eat. She worried that he would either poison her or tranquilize her so he could get a photo of her looking dead to make the police stop looking for her.
If it seems shocking that Katie was able to act with such presence of mind while being held hostage by a suicidal pedophile, it is. According to the Harvard Center on the Developing Child, childhood resilience, or the ability to spring back from adverse childhood experiences, is most often seen in children with at least one secure attachment to a trustworthy adult.
But for Katie, every significant adult in her young life had neglected, abused, or ignored her. Ann Butler, the mother of Linda Ingolari, was mostly kind to Katie and asked Katie to call her mom, but Ann also helped to lure Katie to Linda's house, even after Sal Ingolari had confessed to molesting Katie.
Harvard scientists also point to three other factors in the development of resilience. First, a sense of self-efficacy and perceived control. Second, opportunities to strengthen adaptive skills and self-regulatory capacities. And lastly, sources of faith, hope, and cultural or religious traditions.
Nothing about Katie's childhood was good or even acceptable, but in a way, it's possible that being forced to do an adult's chores and errands from a young age actually functioned to develop her crucial sense of self-efficacy and control. And it may be that the amount of time she spent unattended, visiting local businesses, allowed her to strengthen some adaptive skills.
Katie wasn't religious, and she didn't come from a culture with well-defined traditions. But she had specific goals for her life. She wanted to go to college. She wanted children. She wanted, quote, a normal adult life.
It's possible that these modest goals were just enough to give Katie the hope she needed to survive her captivity.
In hindsight, it's hard to pinpoint any single thing that gave Katie her incredible level of resilience. If you put 100 children into Katie's shoes, few would respond to trauma in the same way she did. It was as if Katie had read Harvard's research on childhood resilience herself, years before it was published, and come up with a plan to counteract her own childhood traumas.
Nobody would call Katie lucky, but in this one aspect of her life, she did better than anyone could possibly expect. She wasn't okay, nor would she be for many years, but where many people would have collapsed and given up, she never lost focus on doing whatever was necessary to survive and regain her freedom.
Back in the outside world, January 12th was a momentous day. It was Katie's 16th day as a prisoner, and it was the first day of a new policy by Suffolk County Police, a complete media embargo.
Katie's case had just appeared in a special episode of the hit TV show America's Most Wanted. When tips from the public flooded in, media attention wasn't dying down, it kept escalating, getting in the way of the cops' investigation.
In their haste to beat each other to new leads, journalists were eating up investigators' time and publishing information that the police didn't want the public to have.
So, on January 12, 1993, police announced they would no longer respond to any media inquiries about the disappearance of Katie Beers.
The wall-to-wall coverage didn't stop, but it stopped including any information from the police. Stonewalled by the police department, the media ramped up their pressure on everyone else in Katie's life, from her battling mother figures to John Esposito, her kidnapper and the prime suspect. Linda, Marilyn, and John Esposito had news vans camped outside their homes, watching their every move.
For all the media attention, Lieutenant Verone still felt sure he had his man, but he was stymied as to how to prove it. John Esposito retained a lawyer, Sidney Sybin, known for being a publicity hound. Sybin was making noises about suing the police for harassment.
Verone was undeterred. He could hardly sleep. He was so worried about Katie Beers. He knew with every passing day, it was less and less likely she would be found alive.
In the bunker, Katie was having trouble sleeping too. With the police no longer talking to reporters, the television in the inner chamber was giving her less useful information about her case. She worried constantly about Big John killing himself or dying, leaving her in the chamber forever.
And Big John's death became a real possibility. He was becoming the most hated man in America as Katie's case dragged on. Not only did the media keep reminding people that Big John was a child molester with a previous arrest for attempted kidnapping, Lieutenant Verone was having him followed and interrogated at every opportunity by detectives, and Katie herself was begging for her freedom.
Under the weight of this, Big John was often suicidal in the final days of Katie's kidnapping. Perhaps he had come to see only two ways out for himself, death or confession.
By telling Big John she loved him, Katie induced him to sympathize with her and played on his affection. By telling him about her dreams of college and a family, she appealed to whatever better nature he had left.
Big John told Katie he wanted to protect her. Maybe hearing from her over and over that she wanted a normal adult life helped him come to the realization that he was stealing her future from her.
Or perhaps Big John simply realized that the police would get the truth out of him one way or another. The pressure from Verone hadn't let up since the day he took Katie. He had to make a change, and finally, he did. On January 13th, the 17th day of Katie's captivity, she heard the power drill that opened the entrance to the bunker. But there was a new sound, too.
Behind Big John were two other men.
Katie froze. The first thought in her mind was that Big John had brought over his friends to rape her, too. She didn't remember him having any adult friends. He really only spent time with children. But why else would there be other men with him?
Big John unlocked the chain around Katie's neck. Two strange men in suits stepped into the chamber.
"Katie," said one of them, "it's safe for you to come out."
We'll continue Katie's story in a moment. Now back to the story. When we left Katie, it was January 13th, 1993, and two strange men had just entered the bunker where she was held for 17 days.
She thought they were there to abuse her. Even after they introduced themselves as police detectives, clever Katie worried that this might be a test. Maybe Big John was checking to see if she meant it when she promised that if he let her go, she wouldn't tell anyone about him.
So Katie kept silent when the strange men asked her if she was all right. She kept quiet as they pulled her out of the bunker, helped her through the tunnel, and urged her up the ladder into Big John's office.
Even after the uniformed men led her into the living room and she saw sunlight for the first time in 17 days, she kept up the pretense of being devoted to Big John.
The uniformed men sat Katie down on the living room sofa and began asking questions. Lieutenant Verone arrived to greet her. Still, as long as she was in Big John's house, Katie trusted nothing. She could only feel safe once Big John was no longer watching her.
So when Verone took her away, Katie hugged Big John and told him she loved him. In case this was the final test, she had to prove she wouldn't betray him. Then maybe he would let her leave unharmed.
Verone carried Katie out to a police car, through a sea of photographers and reporters gathering at the home. It was only when she saw the police car and the many people outside that Katie began to let herself hope this was real. The uniformed men who pulled her out of the bunker really were police detectives.
As the police car pulled away from the home on Saxon Avenue, Katie clutched one thing she'd taken with her from the bunker, $500 in $20 bills, given to her one at a time by Big John while she was held in the bunker. It wasn't the $100 a day Big John promised her for her captivity, but she was leaving with more money than she had ever had before.
More importantly, she was leaving with her life and with her capacity to hope for a better future. From that day on, Katie celebrated January 13th like her birthday. It was the first day of a better life.
Snuggled in the back seat of the police car, weary Katie didn't know how her freedom had come to be. She didn't know that John Esposito had finally cracked and told his attorney, Sidney Seibin, that he had Katie.
Faced with the possibility of being charged as an accessory if he hid this information, Seibin had to counsel his client to confess. But Seibin, always interested in raising his own profile in the media, tipped off the news first. Only then did Seibin allow Esposito to walk into the police station and tell them what he'd done.
And so, when police got to Saxon Avenue with John Esposito, prepared to lead them to Katie, they found that reporters had beaten them there.
If John hadn't confessed, Katie might never have been found. She was too well hidden. Even the police agreed they could have searched the house many more times and never found the entrance to the bunker without Big John's help.
She was relieved to be found, but Katie now had other things on her mind. Where were the police going to take her?
Although Katie had seen enough coverage of her kidnapping on the Bunker TV to know that her mother figure's custody battle was national news, she expected to be taken either to Marilyn or Linda.
Katie never imagined that the police would tell her she didn't have to go either with her neglectful biological mother or her abusive mother figure.
But that's exactly what happened. Katie went to a foster home. After being raked over the coals by the media, police wouldn't risk giving Katie back to her abusers.
At first, Katie thought she was being punished.
Things were very different at the foster home. Katie felt like it must have been her fault she was taken, and it was because she was so irresponsible that she would no longer be allowed to see Marilyn, Linda, Linda's mother Anne, or Marilyn's mother Helen.
Her new foster parents, Barbara and Ted, lived in a storybook-style farmhouse. They knew all about what Katie had been through and were prepared to deal with her traumas. She was welcomed with a pizza party and an ice cream cake. This frightened Katie rather than reassuring her. In the past, when Katie received gifts, it was always a prelude to sexual abuse.
At first, Katie misbehaved in her new home. She rejected her foster parents' gifts, disobeyed their rules, and assumed she would be going back to Marilyn or Linda soon.
According to the state of Washington's training material for foster parents, foster children often misbehave because they're accustomed to not having their needs met. Rather than punishing a foster child, foster parents are encouraged to think about the need they are expressing through bad behavior and try to teach them new ways to ask for that need to be met.
That's what Barbara and Ted did. Barbara was herself an adopted child, while Ted was a military veteran and law enforcement professional. Between them, they understood the traumas that came with being a displaced child and with being the victim of a crime.
Katie soon went back to school, a new school. With patience and affection from her foster parents, she learned to live in an environment where she had her own bed, her own door that could close, and enough food. For the first time, she learned to brush her teeth.
Ted, Katie's foster father, had a hard time connecting with her at first. She was expecting sexual abuse every time they were alone together. It was easier for her to connect with Barbara.
Even as Katie was starting to heal, she had to deal with the consequences of her very public kidnapping. Kids at school interrogated her about it. Reporters laid in wait for her at the school entrance.
District Attorney James Catterson was livid. He held a press conference and, speaking off the cuff after casting his notes aside, begged the media to leave Katie alone. He described Katie as wise and resilient and held up a poster board with the words, "Give Katie a chance."
Catterson publicly pleaded with the media to have compassion for Katie as she returned to school. Surprisingly, they listened. The New York Post published a strongly worded editorial urging their colleagues in journalism to back off.
The news van stopped parking outside Katie's school. People stopped talking about Katie's kidnapping. Instead, neighbors began talking about how important it was for Katie to be left alone so she could heal.
Linda and Marilyn were still battling in the public eye, going on talk shows to slam each other and talk up their own parenting. But the custody court was unimpressed by their public antics.
With input from Katie, a family court judge ruled that Katie would stay in foster care and her biological mother, Marilyn, would have supervised visitation 3 times a week. Katie would also have a money manager appointed for her in case her story was sold and she had earnings her relatives might try to steal.
Katie's strong personality continued to show through. When journalists petitioned to allow cameras in the courtroom for Katie's family court case, Katie herself responded with a handwritten letter pleading, "Please don't put my case on TV. It's bad enough that it's in the papers."
On June 12, 1993, Marilyn finally agreed to give up custody of Katie for at least 1 year. Katie could relax and stop worrying that at any moment she might return to a house without a bed of her own, without a toothbrush or toothpaste.
Marilyn couldn't keep up with what the custody judge wanted her to do to regain visitation or custody, and Linda had no parental rights, despite having physical custody of Katie for years. So Katie never spent another night with Marilyn or Linda again.
But as the family court ordeal ended, criminal court began. On June 28, 1994, Katie had to testify against Sal Ingoleri. He was finally being tried for sexually abusing her. Now 11 years old, Katie courageously told the judge that she was raped more times than she could count, often on Sundays.
Sal pleaded innocent, but the jury believed Katie. Sal was found guilty and spent the rest of his life in jail. On February 21, 2009, Sal died at the age of 55 after refusing medical treatment when he collapsed in his prison cell.
While Sal claimed innocence and forced Katie through an entire trial, John Esposito took a plea deal and answered a judge's questions mostly honestly in order to meet the conditions of his guilty plea. But he continued to deny he had touched Katie sexually or raped her. Even without that confession, the judge accepted Big John's plea and sent him to jail.
Here's District Attorney Catterson speaking about accepting Esposito's confession.
I'm satisfied that he admitted, one, that he held her against her will, that he abducted her, that she did not have the right to leave the place, that he put her in a place where he knew no one would find her or thought no one could find her. And these are all the elements of kidnapping in the first degree, and that's what I was interested in. That's why I asked him those questions.
The plea deal made John eligible for parole after 15 years. But his refusal to fully confess to sexually abusing Katie and Katie's own testimony before the parole board kept him in prison for the rest of his life, too.
Finally, on September 4th, 2013, John had another parole hearing in which he admitted to molesting Katie. He continued to deny he raped her and blamed his attorney, Sidney Sibin, for his initial decision to deny ever touching Katie.
In response to John's confession, Katie released a statement expressing her disappointment that, after 20 years, John was still minimizing the impact of his actions. She didn't want a partial confession from her second rapist.
And she wouldn't get a full one, because later, the same day, Big John Esposito collapsed in his cell and died. Here's a news story from that day, including Katie's comments on his death.
John Esposito's death does not appear to be suspicious, according to officials. He died the same day as his parole hearing without knowing the outcome. Katie Beers, who was held for 17 days, says she is sorry for his family, but not for him.
I've been preparing myself over the past 20 years of two outcomes, the one being paroled and then the one of him dying in prison. So I can't say that I'm not happy that it wasn't the latter.
The 30-year-old noted the coincidence. Her captor died a day after Cleveland kidnapper Ariel Castro committed suicide. Julie Walker, New York.
And as for Katie, Barbara and Ted adopted her. She now calls them her parents and calls Marilyn and Linda by their first names. As we mentioned earlier, she went on to marry and had two children, Logan and Haley.
Kidnapping would be the worst event in most children's lives, but for Katie, it changed the course of her life for the better.
Here she is, in her own words, explaining how her life was changed by her kidnapping.
So until I was abducted, I don't think that I would have ever gotten out of those situations. My life would have gone in a completely different way. I would have never met my husband. I'd probably have six kids by now. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be a good life.
20 years after her kidnapping, when Katie was writing her memoirs, Lieutenant Dominic Verone allowed her to listen to the tapes John Esposito made of her time in the bunker.
Memories came flooding back of moments she had suppressed.
Katie learned from the tapes that she had a strategy that she'd forgotten, perhaps blocked out of her memory. When she was rescued, Katie was in the middle of a campaign to convince Big John she was terribly ill, so ill she might die.
On the tapes, she calls out for him over and over, screams, cries out for Linda, cries out for Big John. Over and over, she tells him she is sick and she needs to go home.
And Katie was in remarkably good health when rescued. healthy enough that the police report indicates that when she finally realized she was really safe, she gleefully exclaimed, quote, "I'm going home. I'm going home."
But according to the tapes, Big John was convinced she was ill. He offered her an extra blanket, soup, and more. He even told her that if he killed himself, he would leave a note pinned to his chest explaining where to find her.
But clever Katie kept pressing him, begging for Linda, even though the abusive woman who had beaten her black and blue with a hairbrush was hardly a safe harbor for Katie.
The worry that Katie might die in his care pushed John Esposito over the edge, leading to his confession. It seems incredible that at 10 years old, Katie managed to rescue herself from a kidnapper using psychological manipulation. But based on the tapes, that's exactly what happened.
Katie is still as resilient as ever. She recultivated a relationship with her half-brother after the publication of her memoir, and she's spoken frequently to the media about her experiences as a kidnapping victim and a survivor of childhood sexual abuse.
But maybe the most important thing she's done for other victims is the simplest. She's happy and healthy, a living illustration of what's possible, even for someone who survived a childhood so horrible, it's almost beyond comprehension.
Here's Katie one more time, telling the Associated Press about how she looks at her life today.
When I look at my life, that's not what I look at. I look at my accomplishments of graduating high school, graduating college, maintaining a job, getting married, having kids. Those are the things that I look at. And now when I look at my life, I'm looking forward to the future.
We've all been through something, and I think we can all agree, no matter what we're dealing with, we could all use a little more of Katie's resilience.
You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Kenny Hobbs, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler, additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Yelena Wohr and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.